And now, Robert Trout in the news, direct from the NBC newsroom in New York, presented by Pillsbury. If you want to put a sparkle in your husband's eye, serve him his favorite homemade pie, or make it pile a mode. But be sure it's your pie, made with the new Pillsbury pie crust mix. Light and flaky, full of flavor. It's quick and easy to make perfect pie crust now. You just add water to Pillsbury pie crust mix. You can fix it while your oven heats. And you'll have plenty for a big, tender, tasty two-crust pie because there are 9 full ounces in every package of Pillsbury pie crust mix. Berries are in season and fresh peaches, too. Get a package of Pillsbury pie crust mix and make that man of yours a wonderful homemade pie of yours. And now, Bob Trout with the latest news.
Berlin is still on the top of the news after 4 days of Russian lightning raids and kidnappings. The Russians admit they've seized 2,500 persons in Berlin this past week, but they say they've released most of them and are now holding only 40. But today, for the first time, they abducted an American, Thomas Hedden, the deputy chief of the American Military Government Information Control Division. The scene of the kidnapping, Potsdamer Platz, the Times Square of Berlin. Hedden was standing near the line that separates the British sector from the Russian. It's not yet completely clear which side of the line he was on, when 3 Russian soldiers armed with Tommy guns forced this American official into a jeep and drove away with him, leaving his wife and children standing in the Berlin street weeping bitterly. In Moscow, the Communist Party newspaper Pravda says the United States State Department is encouraging the American police to use gangster methods against Soviet citizens. The British, American, and French representatives in Moscow held another meeting among themselves, and they waited for a call from Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov. But Mr. Molotov did not invite them into the Kremlin for another meeting today. A Jewish spokesman in Tel Aviv says Israel is now prepared to talk peace separately with the various Arab countries. But in Sweden, the Holy Land mediator, Count Bernadotte, says there seems to be no common ground for an agreement between Arabs and Jews. He's going to hand the Palestine problem back to the United Nations Assembly. It's raining in Paris, and that kept the crowds at home as Paris quietly observed the 4th anniversary of its liberation from the Germans. In Amsterdam, the World Council of Churches ceremoniously opened the most representative gathering of Christian churches in all history, with Protestant representatives and Catholic observers from all over the globe and both sides of the Iron Curtain, but not from Russia. President Truman went to church today at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, stepping ashore from the presidential yacht Williamsburg, in which he's cruising in Chesapeake Bay. Down in Washington, the House Un-American Activities Committee says it's ready to resume hearings tomorrow with 3 surprise witnesses. A spectacular fire in the Pacific. It started when several Navy gasoline tanks exploded on the island of Guam, and it burned fiercely for more than 5 hours, arousing the whole island. At last report, 3 Navy men dead, 1 missing, 1 badly burned. China is getting ready to issue its new money tomorrow, and today Chiang Kai-shek warned the Chinese that if they hoard money or deal in the black market, they'll be tried for high treason. In Shanghai, they put a constable in jail today, but not for treason. A bus conductor slammed a door in the constable's face just as he was trying to climb aboard, according to the rules that prevail all over the world. But the constable pulled out his gun and shot the conductor, and that's against the rules. The constable is in jail. And now for Pillsbury, here's Arthur Gary.
Thank you, Bob Trout. Lady, why not be sure the pie you make will be perfect? It will be if you use Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix, the largest selling pie crust mix in America. It's a perfect blend of the finest ingredients, all by Pillsbury. Your pie crust will have a tempting golden brown color and a rich flavor of fine shortening. It'll be light and tender and flaky, the kind that cuts at the touch of a fork. Get Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix tomorrow. Listen again next Sunday at this time for Robert Trout in the News, brought to you by Pillsbury, greatest name in flour. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
John Adams, second president to his son John Quincy, upon the latter's accession to the White House.
No man who ever held the office of the presidency would congratulate a friend upon obtaining it.
President Woodrow Wilson.
Things get very lonely in Washington sometimes. The real voice of the great people of America often sounds faint and distant.
Franklin Roosevelt in the wartime spring of 45.
The detail of this work is killing me.
Admiral George Dewey, who never became president.
If the American people want me for this office, I'll be only too willing to serve them. Since studying the subject, I'm convinced that the office of the president is not such a difficult one to fill.
Living 1948. Presented each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated independent stations. Once more, taking calendar note that this is a presidential year, holds up its radio mirror to reflect the image of an office in a drama document entitled
The Biggest Job in the World. Your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. Every 4 years come hell or high water, war or peace, good times or bad. The people choose sides and confer upon one of their fellows the highest honor within their power to bestow, the chief magistracy of the Republic. It may be true that Henry Clay once said,
I'd rather be right than president.
And a fellow congressman is said to have addressed the back of his hand,
don't worry, he won't be either.
But the fact remains, Henry Clay sought the presidency in 3 different elections unsuccessfully. It is a post of transcendent importance to the world, and one of transcendent attraction to our statesmen and public servants. So, in this hour of our destiny, whose deep consequence we surely need not labor, we propose to raise certain questions concerning this highest office in the land.
The founding fathers, how did they conceive the presidency, its powers and limitations?
How in a century and a half has the office grown to be what it is today?
What men made it so? And finally, has the presidency become a burden too overwhelming for any one man to handle?
And if so, what can we, the citizens, do about it?
These, America, are the questions we pose and now undertake to answer. For our beginning, we return to Philadelphia. The Philadelphia where this summer we watched 3 conventions choose presidential hopefuls. To that other and earlier convention in the summer of 1787, 161 years ago, had come the finest minds on the continent. Washington, Madison, and Randolph from Virginia. Morris and Hamilton from New York. James Wilson from Pennsylvania, and 20 others. Great men, newly free and determined to remain so, they are fashioning the blueprint of a nation. On this hot summer day in 1788, they debate the place of the executive in their new constitution. General Washington in the chair will presently recognize Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania. The points at issue seem to be whether to repose the executive power in one man or in a group who shall choose the executive, then the question of the length of term of the office, and most important of all, whether the executive shall have real power or be a mere echo of the Congress.
Mr. Wilson, I much prefer a single magistrate.
Oh, you're right.
I maintain the single executive is the breeder of monarchy.
All right, that's right.
Mr. Sherman of Connecticut,
the number should not be picked, but the executive ought to be appointed by and accountable to the legislature.
One moment, please, gentlemen, one moment. If he were to be the guardian of the people, let him be appointed by the people.
The people, then, rather than the Congress, should elect the president, urged James Wilson of Pennsylvania, and that view eventually prevailed. As to tenure,
the term shall be 4 years with no limit on re-election.
As to power,
the executive is nothing more than an instrument for carrying into effect the will of the legislature.
That's the weak view, as against,
we must either renounce the blessings of the Union or provide an executive with sufficient vigor to pervade every part of it.
And what did they settle for? The Constitution, as adopted, quote,
by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. By and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
By and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
But if he veto the measure, he shall return it with his objections to that house in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the...
And if they disagree with his objections, they can repass the bill over his veto.
Many an American pondering the future of his government in 1788 and studying the provisions of the yet-to-be-ratified Constitution was inclined to agree with the Pennsylvania legislature that the presidency wasn't strong enough.
It is probable that the President of the United States, limited as he is in power and dependent on the will of the Senate, will have neither the firmness or the inclination to exercise his prerogative.
So much then for the form and the word, the rhetoric and the compromise, in short, the naked furniture with which the framers of the Constitution supplied the presidency. But in all their wisdom, in all their foresight, the founding fathers reckoned without the mind and flesh and temperament of the men who were to occupy that office.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve.
33 men in all have taken that oath. Of that number, 8, the historians tell us, have played a major role in making the American presidency the biggest job in the world. 8 of 33, respectable average in any league. The role: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Question: what makes for a strong president?
Well, one explanation advanced by historian Edward S. Corwin is summed up in the phrase,
crisis and personality.
A combination: the times and the man. Who knows what president, listed as a mediocrity from the perspective of history, might have risen to the challenge had there been a challenge?
But what about James Buchanan? Didn't he have the challenge of disunion of a seceding South, just as Lincoln did? And all Buchanan did about it was wring his hands and weep.
Yes, my friend, but remember, a combination, we said, the crisis and the man. Now, for reason number 2 for the evolution of presidential power, we call on historian James Bryce.
The larger a community becomes, the less does it seem to respect an assembly. The more is it attracted by an individual man.
The sheer growth of our nation, then, the mere impact of swelling numbers, serve to elevate the prestige of leadership, to make us look to the White House for the answer to questions that trouble us rather than to the Congress.
So much for the national backdrop. So much for the political climate in which the presidency has become the office it is today. Now, what about the men?
Number 1, and first in more ways than one, George Washington. His was the crisis of national birth, and he handled it superbly, with the dignity, the honor, the scrupulous sense of duty, which made him the natural leader in a generation of great men.
George Washington set the pattern for the biggest job in the world.
Number 2, Thomas Jefferson. His contribution?
Assertion of party leadership. He saw in the political party an instrument and a weapon for the hand of the executive. And so President Jefferson summons to the White House a group of party leaders.
And now, gentlemen, I suggest that the proposal for the purchase of the Louisiana Territory be made by you in Congress, rather than publicly by me. This will put upon the purchase a desirable character, as though it be the will of the people and not a mere whim of the executive.
Thus, through his party in Congress, Jefferson devised a tool and set a precedent for moving the wheels of state. Number 3.
By thunder, he's the man for me.
Yes, sirree, a man that is a man.
Tough as nails, a fella to scare sitting hens off their eggs.
They say his old lady can crack walnuts with her teeth.
Sure, regular folks like us.
Yep, he's for the little fella.
He's for us, and we're for him.
We aim to elect a president.
President of the unwashed and unterrified.
Yes, sir, by G. We'll elect our man for a change.
And who is he?
Old Hickory.
Who?
General Andy Jackson.
Yes, echoing through the Cumberland Gap along the Wilderness Road, they were crying his name. The first man of the people, the first hero of the common man, Andrew Jackson. And he came to the White House, this stubborn leader, stubbornly convinced that he bore in the pocket of his faded campaign coat a mandate direct from the people. A mandate bidding him to brook no nonsense from anyone, and least of all from Congress.
Jackson's contribution to the presidency was not so much a stiffening of the office as it was a remaking, a revolution.
12 times bills came down from Capitol Hill, and 12 times they went thundering back,
Veto. He can't do this to us. Why, there have been only 9 vetoes in all past administrations put together.
These words of Jackson in his most famous veto message struck the national ear as pretty rugged stuff.
The opinion of the Supreme Court has no more authority over Congress than the opinion of Congress over the court. And on that point, the president is independent of both.
Of course, Congress shook its mane and thundered back, cried Daniel Webster.
Such a universal power of judging over the laws and over the decisions of the judiciary is nothing else but pure despotism.
And Henry Clay, backing Webster in this battle of the giants.
We are in the midst of a revolution, rapidly tending toward the concentration of all power in the hands of one man. There has been a total...
Remember, friends, this is 1833, not 1933.
The powers of Congress are paralyzed, except when exerted in conformity with his will.
But in this contest, Jackson knew the odds were all on him. In fact, there were no odds, and there was no contest. For time after time, the voters returned Jackson men to Congress. In his iron bid for presidential strength, the people were behind Jackson. Number 4 among the men who made the presidency strong. The crisis. A nation divided, brother against brother, the war between the states. And the man?
Abe Lincoln.
Buchanan, frustrated and futile in the face of an issue which seemed bigger than the nation itself, had said...
You have no right to secede, but I can do nothing to stop you.
But Buchanan's successor, that long, lank, unknown quantity from Illinois, in his inaugural address sang a somewhat different tune.
No state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union. I shall take care, as the Constitution enjoins me, that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall in some authoritative manner direct the contrary.
Note well, America, 2 essential points in Abraham Lincoln's conception of the presidential office. First,
his duty to preserve the Constitution.
Surpassed only by...
his duty to respect the sovereignty of the people.
Yes, like Jackson, Lincoln had instinct for the sense and substance of the people, and a feel for their essential strength. Not, however, in support of the naked theory of presidential power, but rather for the preservation of the common good, in short, the Union. Throughout the agony of those years, the war years, Lincoln never allowed the terrible press of official business to raise a partition, an iron curtain, 1865, so to speak, between the president and the people.
Now, General, if you'll excuse me...
But, Mr. President, I had hoped...
I'm sorry, General. There are others waiting. People I must see.
But when I came through your anteroom, Mr. President, there was no one.
No one?
Well, the room was full, of course, but riffraff, sir, riffraff. I mean to say such common people.
Exactly. Like me, and I'd better not forget it.
Oh, but...
I see them every day, General, rain or shine.
Mr. President, you
yes,
can't
Yes,
mean...
General, I call these daily interviews with the common people, as you say, I call them my public opinion baths.
Your public opinion baths?
Because they're renovating and invigorating. They help me remember how much I rely more... how much the future of all of us depends on the confidence and common sense of our fellow citizens.
Yes, Lincoln avowed and never forgot that the source and final repository of power and wisdom lay not with the president, nor the Congress, nor the court, for they were merely instruments, but with the people. And that's why when the time came for him to assert most eloquently, most finally, the timeless, deathless indivisibility of the Union, he chose not the halls of Congress, but an open field where common men had died and where common men had now come to listen.
Here gave the last full measure of devotion that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Bearing in mind, America, the spiritual link between president and people established by Jackson and Lincoln, we can better understand some of the statements of the other four strong presidents who came after.
Grover Cleveland, man of conscience.
Public office is a public trust.
Theodore Roosevelt, leader of opinion.
The White House is a bully pulpit.
Woodrow Wilson, political scholar.
The president must be the spokesman for the real sentiment and purpose of the country.
And in our time,
the presidency is preeminently a place of moral leadership. All our great presidents were leaders of thought at times when certain historic ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified.
Again, we find pertinent the words of that classic commentator upon us, the Englishman James Bryce.
Nowhere is the rule of public opinion so strong as it is in America, or so direct. A president is strong because his rights come straight from the people.
And don't think our strongest presidents haven't known it. By slow accretion through the years, and as we've seen, with the consent of the people, the power of the president has steadily grown. Until today, the president embodies in himself such a multiplicity of functions, such a versatility of duties and demands upon him, that in the words of Mrs. Warren G. Harding,
I don't want my husband in the White House. The office is killing President Wilson, just as surely as if he had been stabbed at his desk.
Inventory. 7 items of the presidential load.
Chief of State.
Here, Washington was preeminent.
Chief of Administration.
Cleveland was outstanding here.
Chief of Legislation.
Score 1 here for Woodrow Wilson.
Chief of Public Opinion.
The fireside chat, remember?
Chief of Foreign Relations.
Tread softly and carry a big stick.
Chief of Party.
Jefferson set that pattern.
Commander in Chief.
Lincoln, Wilson, FDR. Seven items, and everyone certainly in itself a full-time job, in its larger policy-making aspect alone. Now, add to that the endless detail.
Mr. President, these bills are ready for your signature.
Yes, every act of Congress, every commission in the armed forces, every proclamation, appointment, federal pardon, executive order, must be signed by the indispensable hand. All the way from...
The state of war between the United States and the imperial government of Japan, which has thus been thrust upon the United States, is hereby...
Formed. Down to this.
The Congress directs the Treasury to pay the sum of $100 to Rastus L. Davis of Winona, Texas, in full settlement of all claims against the United States for the watermelons stolen by soldiers from a patch near Camp...
Yes, thousands upon thousands of times a year, the president signs his name. With the same hand which, in reception line after reception line, grasps the hand of king and commoner, until, in the words of one writer, his palm grows gray with the grime of democracy. In fact, they tell a story about Theodore Roosevelt. It's toward the end of a long and weary public function at the White House. At last, the president, through tired eyes, sees the end of the reception line approaching. A little man, neutral with the hue of anonymity, steps eagerly forward. He's a Washington tailor, and he murmurs...
You don't remember me, Mr. President. I'm the man who made your shirts.
Oh, yes. It's nice to see you again, Major Shirts.
Yes, even the irrepressible Teddy, even that arch-apostle of the strenuous life, sometimes succumbed to the occupational disease, presidential fatigue.
Add state dinners. 6 a season by protocol.
Add
openings, dedications, laying of cornerstones, welcoming delegations.
Add
press conferences.
Just one more question, Mr. President, if you don't mind, sir. And since you've made this one off the record...
After one particularly trying bout with the press, one recent president is said to have observed...
I feel as though I've just been examined by the entire staff of Mayo Brothers.
In short, the president combines in himself functions performed in England by king, prime minister, cabinet officers, other officials.
And we, the people, insist that he do it.
To which sentiment Grover Cleveland wearily responded.
When a man assumes a public trust, he should consider himself public property.
Taking President Cleveland at his word that the president is indeed public property, we went to a man who knows the public best, our friend Bill Lydgate, editor of the Gallup Poll, through which we regularly make known your collective view on public matters. Bill, can you tell us what qualities we, America, look for in a president?
Well, Ben, above all else, we seem to want him to be a humanitarian, a benevolent father, a helper of the common man.
I see.
For example, expressed in many different ways, the people told us...
If I were president, I'd try to do something to make the people in the slums happier.
I'd fight for the poor people and see they don't get fooled by the greedy.
So many children don't get enough to eat. I'd want to help.
I'd work for peace, world peace. I'd try to improve the education of the people.
And a certain First Lady, Ben, when once asked her view of presidential qualifications, said,
"Yes, the president should be both a politician and a good administrator. But far more than these qualities, he needs an understanding heart."
Reviewing now the amazing complex of duties which the president has by mandate from ourselves and the attributes of character which we insist he have, we will, I'm sure, agree upon the aptness of our title,
The Biggest Job in the World.
Is it any wonder, then, that there is only one living ex-president, that the office is said to shorten the life of the incumbent by half a decade? As Woodrow Wilson put it,
"We shall be obliged to pick our chief magistrate from among wise and prudent athletes, a small class, for men of ordinary physique and discretion cannot be president and live if the strain be not somehow relieved."
There you are, America. Is, as Wilson said, the strain too great to expect any man to bear? This is your office, your creation, as we've been at pains to show you. Many proposals have been advanced, and bear in mind that most, if not all of them, would involve constitutional amendment, measures for presidential relief. Two of the most important, most responsibly advanced.
One, the addition of a second vice president to assume many of the administrative burdens.
Two, administrative reorganization. At this moment, the subject of intensive study by a commission under the chairmanship of ex-President Hoover.
Other suggestions.
More than one executive.
Remember the debate of 1788. Or
delegation of more of the burden to the vice president as now constituted.
And by the way, 80% of you, the American people, have endorsed this. And finally,
a closer coordination between executive and legislature, making cabinet members, by constitutional requirement, also members of Congress.
It implies no disrespect, America, to say now, and it needs to be said and understood, that the President of the United States is your creature. You made the office. You picked the man. Whom you pick and what his burden is, the size of his caliber, how he fits his day and time, are matters of personal and immediate concern not only to you and to me, but to every child in China, to every man alive. And in summing up, I can do no better than to quote from the Yale Review the words of historian Clinton Rossiter. During the next few months, he says, the virtues of the rival candidates will be dinned into our ears with increasing insistence. In weighing their claims to the presidency, the voter would do well to keep the picture of the overburdened condition of this office in the front of his political mind. We should not expect to find in any one candidate the integrity of Washington, the humanity of Jefferson, the courage of Jackson, the charity of Lincoln, the conscientiousness of Cleveland, the energy of Theodore Roosevelt, the intellect of Woodrow Wilson, or the political acumen of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Nor should we forget that some men grow in the White House and some men shrink. Nevertheless, certain demands we can reasonably make. Resolution, competence, and experience our next president must have, and administrative skill as well. Otherwise, the burden of the office may prove too great for his health and for ours and the world's as well. Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC Public Affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Today's script was written by Wade Arnold from research prepared by Nancy Ann Woodard. Milton Kadams conducted the music, and technical advice was by Jane Tiffany Wagner. The program was directed by Jack Cuney. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1948 by joining us next week when, on the eve of Greetings from the President 1948, we present a drama document entitled
New Draft, New Army.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.